Coming up next on 94.7 WTVC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something, co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence. Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss how the latest policies are affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. And now, here's Ellen.
Apropos of Something, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, resistance radio, and persistence radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we have two important scholars who are not only doing incredible work in their fields, but who recently made the shortlist of all-time favorite teachers of University of Virginia alumni. One of those professors is historian Claudrina Harold, who is focused on Black student activism at UVA, and who not only instructs through the classroom, but has produced and co-directed 6 short films featured in international film festivals and beyond. She teaches the very popular class Blackfire, which is also a multimedia initiative documenting the struggle for social justice and racial equality at the University of Virginia. With all of this, I personally hope we also get to her work around the artistry and politics of African-American gospel music. And we talk with Jahan Ramazani, one of the world's leading literary and poetry scholars. He's been called the most knowledgeable, imaginative, and influential minds in his field. He's written and edited numerous books and collections, and in doing so, he's been said to have reshaped the literary landscape of the field for millions of students worldwide. So my friend Nancy, with all of that intimidating us sitting here, how are you and are you there?
I am here. I'm here, and I'd like to say, just from 30 seconds, let's just say that New York City happens to be on Earth 3. Let's just say it really is 3. Saturday. And I want to tell you, not about Putin, not about the State of the Union, not about possible governor resignations. Let's just talk about the fact that, if I may, Punxsutawney Phil, whatever it is, if he did or didn't, all I know is it's going to be an early spring. Whichever one the shadow reflects. It's an early spring. That might be like a lead-in for a Saturday show.
I know. I was so surprised that you talked about that. But speaking of shadows,
I can't believe I talked about that, considering the world's on fire, frankly.
Right. There's so many shadows. That's how it's pertinent. That's how it relates. There's a lot of shadows going
on.
Yes. And Virginia smack in the middle of the news.
State shadow? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Virginia smack in the middle of the news again. Ralph Northam appears as one of two people in a 1984 yearbook in blackface or full Klan hood. One of the two. And everyone is calling for his resignation, as far as I can tell. And what would be justice, in my opinion, is that Justin Fairfax, the Democratic lieutenant governor, would succeed him because, I don't know if you know this in New York, but Northam intentionally left him off because he's African-American. At the request of a union, some union, he left him off his campaign flyers.
Yeah, how ironic is all of that, you know? And the only people I don't, no surprise, you know, who are calling for his resignation, the GOP, you know, those who let Roy Moore run, and that Senator Cindy Hyde Smith, you know, she's cool, Stephen King's cool, the president's cool, but this guy, you know, but,
right.
I mean, he should resign. But
right.
Regardless, the GOP is right there.
Yeah,
up
exactly.
In arms.
Maybe I'll save some of the stuff I want to talk about up front, because I know you have a couple events you wanted to mention.
Yes, just very, very quickly. Back to, like, Earth One, is that on Tuesday, not his State of the Union, but after his State of the Union, that Stacey Abrams is going to give the Democratic response to that, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're going to watch anything on television regarding the White House. And then the next day, the first time ever since the Democrats took control, we're having a House subcommittee meeting on preventing gun violence actually going to happen? Those two.
That's I know. It's the first time in 8 years that there's going to be a hearing on gun violence. I know. And all through all of the horrible atrocities, Sandy Hook, San Bernardino, Las Vegas, Squirrel Hill, all through that, no hearings on gun violence. So thanks for mentioning. So you can find Apropos of Something on Apple Podcasts and a great app that I just learned about called Overcast, which I think is a little bit better, in my opinion, than Apple Podcasts. We are there, and I wanted to, with no further ado, get to our first guest. We are very honored to have her here today, Claudrina Harold. She is a professor of African American and African Studies and History, affiliated with both the University of Virginia's Corcoran Department of History and the Carter G. Woodson Institute. As part of her ongoing work on the history of Black student activism at UVA, she wrote, produced, and co-directed with Kevin Everson 6 short films. These films have been screened at the National Gallery of Art, the Whitney Museum, the Berlin International Film Festival, and almost a dozen more. She teaches the very popular class Black Fire, which is also a multimedia initiative documenting the struggle for social justice and racial equality at the University of Virginia. She has also authored or co-written several books, including the recent Charlottesville 2017, The Legacy of Race and Inequity. Virginia Magazine quotes a University of Virginia alum saying, "Professor Harold has for over a decade been offering a thrilling and more honest view of history in her African American studies classes. She also shares her knowledge in the wider community. She is a true gem, and her legacy at UVA is very real." Welcome to our show, Claudrina.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, so we are, as I said, super honored to have you here. Your class and initiative, Black Fire, as I mentioned, examines Black student activism at UVA. Can you take us through some of that history, and does it start, in your view, with 1969, the events on the steps of the Rotunda, where students were protesting the university's racist atmosphere?
Yes and no. February of 1969, about 1,000 students assembled at the historic Rotunda to register their frustration with the university and what they called its racist atmosphere. And they made a series of demands to increase the Black presence, the establishment of a Black studies program by the fall of 1969, and a living wage for workers, as well as the right of workers to collectively organize/unionize. And that was in 1969, but that's actually 5 years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which basically said that you could not discriminate based on race, gender, national origin. And I should note, it's also 15 years after the passage of Brown versus Board of Education. But that is a seminal event in terms of the history of student activism on grounds. And so in the class, we sort of start with 1969, though, thinking about 1964, and we trace the history of student activism, anti-war protest, and we move through the 1970s looking at African-American students coming to the university en masse and really building a institutional and cultural infrastructure through various organizations.
And what, Claudrina, what kind of resources are you able to access, and or do the students access? What do you have there as far as documentation?
So the protest that I just talked about, we actually, my colleague Kevin Everson and I, when we were doing our first film called Sugar-Coated Arsenic, we found actually reel-to-reel 16mm of the protest, silent. There was no audio. It was about 5 minutes. It cost us about $1,500 to process, but it was sort of a moving image. And so that's one of the things that we've sort of discovered, but also going through student newspapers, going through troves of rare pictures. And so in addition to that, interviewing a lot of early African-American students, African-American faculty. So it's been an interesting process.
Can I ask, I know you're the teacher, but I know this class is really very popular. So why do you think what do students tell you they like about this class so much?
Well, I think it's they're self-centered. And so it's a class about students, and it's a class about student activism. So I think there's a way in which they can see themselves in the class. They can also see the ways in which the unfolding of history, the arrival of African Americans, the arrival of women. I mean, remember, University of Virginia does not go co-ed until 1970, 1971. And so they understand that many of these students who are engaged in protests are creating a university, the modern UVA, that they experience. And so they're studying the history of, say, the formation of Black Studies. So that enables them to understand how there is a Black Fire, how there is a Professor Harold in front of the classroom. And so I think this is very important for the students, but also that they can be involved in the making and the archiving of history. So one of the things that we do as a group project is at the end of the class, they do an oral history project where they go out and they interview alums. After August 11th and 12th, one of the things that I had them do was interview each other, but also interview their colleagues to create an archive about this post August 11th and 12th moment in Charlottesville. And one of the things I'm very clear about and to them is that you have a opportunity to create history. You have an opportunity to archive history, that I'm not the sole teacher in this class. You are also teachers. And then through the class, they see some of the reading assignments that we have are actually interviews that the students did in previous classes. So they see evidence of how their work will be used in the future.
So you mentioned this Black Fire. What do you mean by that?
I'm not very original with titles. And so one of my favorite anthologies is by the late, great poet Amiri Baraka, also known as Leroy Jones. And he had an anthology called Black Fire. And it comes out of the sort of Black Power, Black Arts movement. And I love that. And I'm not original.
It's just
known as the...
Yeah, that's why it took Ellen 15 minutes to introduce you. That's right.
Right. You're not original. You're nothing to say.
Yeah.
Can you, Claudina, about the six film, actually now seven, the seven films you made, I know there are so many, but can you talk about them a little, each one? And, of course, if you want to... however you want to address them, and also, of course, the most recent one, Black Bus Stop.
Sure. So the most recent film, Black Bus Stop, which just played at the International Film Festival of Rotterdam this time last week. So I was actually in the Netherlands last week. But it is a film that looks at this historic spot, historic place on the University of Virginia called the Black Bus Stop. And it was a site of play. It was a site of politics. It was a site of sort of social gathering. So it was a actual bus stop where at the sort of height of African-American student enrollment, hundreds of African-Americans would be there talking, debating politics, listening to music, and waiting for the bus to come. And so we wanted to sort of remember that moment and that spot. And so the film is about 10 minutes. And you see a group of African-American students sort of informally talking, and then it turns dark. And then you see historic Black fraternities and sororities come out with their different steps. And so it was our way to sort of honor the interiority of the Black experience, the organizations that African-American students made, created, the culture they created. I think in this moment where we understandably are attempting to trace the history of white supremacy and talk about white supremacy at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, that it's important that we don't render African Americans as perpetual victims of white supremacy. And so in many ways, I think that's what these films have been attempting to do. The first film looked primarily at an African American woman by the name of Vivian Gordon, who was the first woman director of African American Studies. She was the director from 1975 to 1980. And she came back to the university in 84 and gave a speech at the university. And we recreated that speech. And so the first film, Sugar-Coated Arsenic, centers around her speech, but it also centers around some of the protest footage that we found, some of the articles that, you know, newspaper articles that we read. So that is a history of sort of Black social intellectual life at the University of Virginia. The second film is called We Demand, and it centers on the anti-war protests right after the four co-eds at Kent State University were murdered. And University of Virginia, like other universities across the country became a center of political protest. I think by 10:30 that night, on Monday night, May the 4th, 1970, about 1,500 students assembled at the Rotunda to register their outrage at the murder of those four co-ed students. And for the next week, there was just a series of protests led by a gentleman by the name of James Roebuck, who is now a U.S. representative representing West Philly, but who was actually a graduate student at the University of Virginia and the first African-American to lead student council. The next film that we made was called Fastest Man in the State, which looks at the integration of UVA's athletic department. UVA was the last school in the ACC to bench Jim Crow. And so this 9-minute film is on that experience. And then the next film was a film called How Can I Ever Be Late, which is, of course, taken from Sly Stone's song, If You Want Me to Stay. And it's a 4-minute kind of film video that's done really well. It's played at the London Film Festival, and I also played at International Film Festival Rotterdam, BAM Cinema Fest. But it's a film that looks at a group of black students picking up Sly Stone from the airport, because while Sly Stone was a pop star, there were not provisions made to actually pick him up from the Charlottesville airport. So you get a group of black students in this, like, horrible car, raggedy car, picking up Mr. Funk from the airport, Sly Stone. And so we recreated that for like 5 minutes. So that's some of the, that's just a sampling of some of the stuff that we've done.
You said UVA was at the center of some of the protests. How do you feel UVA fared, you know, coming out of that period?
It's interesting. And I think, so UVA, in terms of the black student population, their enrollment numbers are a lot better than other historically white colleges and universities in Virginia and in other parts of the South during that time. But I think it's a story of regress and progress. By 1976, 1977, there are about 500 black students at the university. And that's comparably better than a lot of other schools in Virginia. At the same time, in 1974, there's a protest over the fact that the university president and 144 other UVA faculty members and administrators belong to an all-white country club called Farmington that did not allow racial minorities to join, and Jews as well. So this is 1974. Wow. And so this is an example of how you can have progress and regress. The previous president, Edgar Shannon, withdrew his membership in 1967.
Withdrew his membership from
Farmington.
Okay,
in 67,
gotcha.
the previous president, Edgar Shannon.
Okay.
Interesting.
Yes, right.
And then,
it's interesting we're saying, because Jahan is the Edgar Shannon professor. And I was wondering, you know, our guests always relate in some way. And I was wondering about that. So go on.
Yeah. And I mean,
I was just,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Okay. I was just wondering, Claudrina, I know that you do write a lot of books. And now that you're doing all these, well, 7 at least, films, is this, do you prefer to direct or star? I mean, do you think you'll be involved in both, or are you, you know, is this inspiring? Does this affect your research, your forward, you know, things you do in the future?
I view it as all interconnected. All of these things I do with my colleague and my comrade, Kevin Everson. And so I view it as all interconnected. Teaching, writing, art, it's all connected. And I think I'm a person that's just right now at this stage in my life in search of form. And so when I hear a story, and if it's moving and it's compelling, the question becomes, what container am I going to put it in? It may be a film, but it may be a class. I mean, I think classes and lectures have, you know, the ability to convey so many things. I think my most profound impact is as a teacher. I mean, every semester I get Black Fire may have, you know, last semester it had 256 students last year. And that was right after August 11th and 12th. So I had an opportunity to talk to people every Tuesday and Thursday for an hour and 15 minutes. And I think that's one of the greatest forms you could have. So for me, it's a question of, do I want this story to be rendered in 16 millimeter? Do I want this story to be rendered in a lecture? Do I want this story to be rendered in a text? And I think there's that constant struggle. I mean, yeah, I go to film festivals and there always be kind of this traditional academic who will say, well, when are you going to write this book? Mm-hmm. And to be perfectly honest with you, like my first film, which centers on the struggles and triumphs of Vivian Gordon, who went through a lot in terms of racial discrimination and sexism at the University of Virginia, I don't think I could have written anything with my talent that would have been more beautiful than what I was able to do collectively with my students and most importantly with Kevin. I mean, so to have an opportunity to work with a world-class filmmaker like Kevin and to tell him my ideas and to see those ideas beautifully rendered in 16 millimeter, it doesn't get better than that. And so that's how I would sort of answer that question.
Well, I'm glad In Search of a Forum that you also chose to be here to speak with our listeners. And we will be right back with Claudrina Harrell. This is WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville 94.7. And of course, you're listening to Apropos of Something. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. We're speaking with Claudrina Harrell.
Hey, Claude.
Go ahead.
Okay. I was referring to the books you've written in the past, and I was just wondering why you chose the Garvey Movement as your first book.
Right. So my first book was on the Marcus Garvey Movement and looking at the hundreds of thousands of African Americans, including many in the South, who supported this Black nationalist organization that basically said that the history and the destiny of people of African descent in the United States and in Europe and South and Central America and the Caribbean and in Africa was connected. And I chose it. I think I selected that topic because I was in undergraduate school during the 1990s and sort of at the height of the moment of cultural and political nationalism. And in 1995, there was the Million Man March. And in 1997, there was the Million Woman March. And it was very interesting to me to think about the support that African Americans have had for movements that emphasize political and cultural self-determination, Black pride. And I was interested in some of the historical roots of that, interested in understanding the movement like the Garvey Movement, which included folks like Malcolm X's parents. And that led me to study Garveyism, but I was also interested in the South. And I was interested in studying this movement in the South and understanding the plurality and the diversity of African-American activism in the South, that the movement has not just been towards integration, it's not just been liberal integration, that has been progressive, has been nationalist, has been very labor movement oriented, et cetera. And so I wanted to understand Black nationalism, but from the perspective of people from the South, like myself.
Could we get into music a little bit? Can you talk about the gospel music that you write about and that you talk about? Or what you focus on in terms of gospel? Or do you? I assume that you do.
Yeah. So the current book that I'm working on now is a history of African-American gospel music from 1968 until 1994. And I'm interested in the ways in which African-Americans have turned to gospel music for spiritual nourishment and uplift, for economics, for a sense of belonging. And I'm interested in sort of the politics of gospel music, the theological tensions within gospel music that are reflective of some of the theological tensions in the African American church. So I explore gospel music from basically 1968 until 1994. And the reason I stop at 1994, that's sort of the year of the emergence of a really popular gospel artist named Kirk Franklin. It's also the emergence of kind of the internet. And I think once the internet, not emergence of the internet, but when really the internet takes over music, analyzing popular music becomes much more complex, I think, and difficult when you kind of get into the mid-90s and into the 2000s, and so I wanted to stop there. And 68, because I think a lot of times when I tell people I'm doing a book on gospel music, everyone will ask me, when did Mahalia Jackson die? And she died in 1972. But I think there's a lot of scholarship on what we call sometimes the classic era of gospel music from, say, the 1930s and into the 1960s. But I actually wanted to look at this later period, which is in some ways the sort of classic period of commercial gospel music and the rise of crossover music, like the music of Edwin Hawkins and Oh Happy Day and the Winans and Take Six and Kirk Franklin. So that's what I've been working on for the past 2 or 3 years. This book on gospel music, which is in many ways a labor of love, and it's an art form that I've always been interested in. And I must say, working on a gospel book and also kind of co-editing the Charlottesville 2017 book was really an emotional roller coaster. But I think engaging the history of Charlottesville and everything that was going on in that moment was made a lot easier when I could turn on, my iPod and listen to Aretha Franklin's Amazing Grace.
Do you feel that there's a difference or a departure in urban, contemporary gospel music from its past? Do you?
Yes, in some ways. I think the constant in gospel music, the one tradition, has been changed. And, people like Thomas Dorsey and Mahalia Jackson, when they were singing in the 30s and the 40s, there were people who said it was too bluesy. And so then when you get to the 1960s and the 1970s with people like Edwin Hawkins, folks said, oh, that's too funky. That's too soul, too much soul. And then when you get to someone like Kirk Franklin in the 1990s, some folks said, that's just too out there. It's too much hip hop. And so I think there has been constant change. And so I'm interested in sort of documenting that change and how people talk about that change, how people talk about that change in terms of a language of racial authenticity. So as the music changes and as it moves away sometimes from its 1930s or 1940s roots, some artists would be criticized for not just selling out in terms of crossing over into R&B, but kind of selling out in terms of engaging in a form of almost cultural suicide, that you're, when you begin to experiment with other forms and other genres, that you, in some ways, you lessen the essence and the impact of this music. But of course, the problem is that it's always changed. But you hear that in every genre. I mean, in the 1980s, for example, there are folks who are saying, or in the 1970s, I mean, think about the response to the music of people like Miles Davis and Herbie Hancock and Donald Byrd. Folks was like, no, this is, Miles, go back to Kinda Blue. We don't want to hear On the Corner, or, so there's always been this tension, and you see it in the 70s and the 80s, even with soul music. I mean, think about, in some ways, in the 80s, the response to Whitney Houston, this idea that her music was too pop, that it lacked soul, it lacked grit. And so there's always these conversations about the music and what it says about the culture and where the culture is and where it's going. And so gospel is like any other art form. It's a site of great cultural and political contestation.
Right. You can't just celebrate it. You have to pick it apart, right, at the same time or something.
Yeah, that's what the reviewers tell me. They say I do a little too much celebrating, It's like, but that's like, how am I going to criticize Aretha Franklin's Amazing Grace? No. Too many superlatives. It's like.
There's a reason for that.
That's right.
The intimidate. And, what prompted the article you contributed to, the one Rage Against the Machine, that had to, well, I know you know what it's about, I'm just going to explore, the penitentiary blues, the evolution of the penitentiary blues, what prompted that?
So that particular article is from a edited volume that I did with Deborah McDowell, who's the director of the Woodson Institute, and it's called The Punitive Turn. And we had a conference in 2009, or 2010, wow, I can't remember, that looked at the problem of punishment and the problem of mass incarceration, and looked at its history, looked at its sociological effects, but also looked at some of the cultural productions that come out of that moment. And so my contribution to the volume, in addition to helping out with the introduction, I wanted to sort of explore the theme of resistance against mass incarceration, against the sort of racial injustices of the criminal injustice system from sort of the blues era to the hip hop era. And so I traced this genealogy of African-American music and resistance to the criminal justice system by looking at sort of classic blues records, looking at like the Angola prison blues and spirituals, and going through the 1970s and looking at the music of people like Gil Scott-Heron, who I think is one of our great all-time political voices. His analyses are just so incisive. And then going into the 1980s and 1990s, looking at hip-hop groups like Public Enemy and N.W.A. That critiqued the war against drugs and critiqued the problem of mass incarceration.
Wow. So what would you want to leave us with? I think there's a million questions we could ask, but what would you choose to leave us with, Claudina Harold? You want me to get more specific?
Yeah.
You were nodding, so I was like, okay, she's on board. Well, one question that was more specific, what are your students teaching you? Because you mentioned that you both learn from each other.
I mean, I think the thing that is most important for me right now as I think about form and as I think about where we're going, I mean, I always say train your replacement. And so I think in this political moment in which there are so many issues to confront, for me as a teacher, it's just very important for me to convey these lessons and to convey a sort of critical thinking to my students, but also to be open enough to sort of be influenced by them. And so in many ways, I've been talking about form, and I think one of the most important things in this moment is just to sort of embrace the spirit of improvisation and embrace the spirit of improvisation in terms of culture, in terms of politics, in terms of education. We must be open to challenging, I think, institutional infrastructures and traditions, but I think we must also be open to thinking in new and innovative ways.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. I know you have another gig, so let me take your picture and Nancy can chat a little bit. Will you chat with us?
Yeah, sure. No, I was here. I was thinking that we wouldn't have time for news of note, but maybe I should just squeeze this in while you're snapping a photo.
Okay.
Yes, listen, the Republicans, speaking of, I've referenced them earlier, up to no good. They are up to no good. They're going scorched earth yet again. They're going to be changing the Senate rules to make it easier to stack the federal bench with more Trump judges before the end of March. It's they'll be, you know, cutting debate time and lowering, and allowing for lower level nominees, the acceleration and confirmation of Trump's picks. And I have to say, there's like there's 112 vacancies that they're planning on filling. In the last 2 years of Obama's presidency, they conferred 23 of his, and they're up for 121. Anyway, so
yes.
There's that.
Okay. We'll skip mine. I'll just do a little brief. That the House Intelligence Committee is now named. The GOP leadership needed to do that in order for the transcripts to be released, among other things, like conducting regular business and issuing subpoenas. So that delay messes things up, but at least that committee is now seated. Very, very important. So that, as I mentioned, for one thing, like over 50 witnesses' transcripts can now go to Mueller, and he can bring charges for lying to Congress, as we know.
Yeah, no, it's great.
Yes. So with no further ado, our next guest is Jahan Ramazani. He is the Edgar F. Shannon Professor in the Department of English. He's considered one of the world's leading literary scholars. And quoting from the Huffington Post, as an editor of Norton Anthologies, a poetry encyclopedia, and other works, Ramazani has reshaped the literary landscape of the field for millions of students worldwide. He's a prize-winning teacher. He has instilled in thousands of students an appreciation for poetry and art that may have previously seemed esoteric or inaccessible. His scholarly achievements and numerous awards demonstrate the power and originality of his work. One of his books, Poetry of Mourning, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and another, A Transnational Poetics, won an American Comparative Literature Association prize for the best book in comparative literary history. He's received so many awards. A few of them are a Guggenheim Fellowship, a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship, the Modern Language Association's William Riley Parker Prize, and the Thomas Jefferson Award. He was recently elected to one of the oldest and most prestigious societies in the United States, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Welcome to the show, Jahan.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, so the Norton Anthologies caught my ears because it's just one of the things that undergrads of English literature are almost always required to read. So, and why? So why is it so important to study literature?
Why is it important to study literature? Well, because it speaks to our souls. It speaks to the present day. It connects us to the past. It brings our sensory equipment alive. It helps us to think critically. It does so many things. It tunes our ears to the finer points of the language. You know, the great literary artists are those who've done the best work possible with the language in which they work. And I think we can all learn from that, particularly maybe in this time when language tends to get degraded, reduced to cliche, as our tempers get ever hotter and our polemics get ever fiercer.
I know, Ellen, you want to go to break, so I'm not even going to bother.
You sound so dejected. I'm so sorry. We are going to go to a break. We're speaking with Jahan Ramazani, who I just introduced, and we will be right back, so stick with us, everybody. Welcome back, everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Apropos of Something Now on Apple Podcasts and on Overcast. Nancy.
My question is actually not for you, Ellen. It's for Sean. you mentioned the anthology. You've done a few, more than a few anthologies. So what is involved, since we have all been students dealing with these anthologies, what's involved with what winds up in each of these books that we love and hate?
Yeah. Hate? Somebody hates anthologies?
I like mine.
Oh, they're great. I mean, one of the reasons I decided to do them is because, it's just charming to see how people will, even after they've taken their classes with their anthologies, cart them from apartment to apartment, year in and year out, read around in them. At least some students do this. But the creation of anthologies is really a fairly complex process. I know the canon looks like it's, you know, prefab somehow, ready there for us, already made. But it takes a lot of work to figure out, you know, what are the great works that you want to make sure that everyone's read? What are some of the works that have been neglected, people, marginal in one way or another at one or another point in time or one another place on the planet, how to bring them in. And then there's a complex negotiation with other teachers. We always do surveys to see what teachers want to teach. So you want to reflect their desires. But at the same time, you want to kind of push them a little bit because you want to help reshape the field, push it in new directions as well. And then there is a little bit of a complicated financial element as well, because whenever you're reprinting poems or novels or plays or short stories that were printed initially after 1923 for the most part and are under copyright, you need to negotiate with publishers and pay permissions fees for reproducing those. And so then you're faced with a question of, they want, you know, $600 for this poem. Is it worth $600 when we could get three poems by this other person in for the same amount of money? So there actually is a kind of financial element to it as well.
So can you talk a little bit about a transnational politics, because it's a global sort of topic, and I know you have some opinions, but also a lot of literary things to say about that. Could you tell us about why that's important?
Sure. So I got very interested in. Let me start by saying the tradition of literary teaching, of course, has been largely nation-based. We've understood, American literature in terms of American history and American canons and so forth. Same for English poetry, Irish poetry, and all the rest. I became increasingly alert as I started studying, reading about, and writing about poetry from the Caribbean, Africa, India, other parts of the world. I became increasingly alert to the ways in which, particularly from the 20th century on, poetry becomes increasingly transnational. That is, writers are responding to other writers across national and political and geographic borders. And it seemed to me that that was very much inadequately addressed in the critical literature. And yet, it seemed to me crucial to understand what it was like for, say, a Barbadian poet like Kamau Brathwaite in Barbados to hear the canonical English and American poet T.S. Eliot's work, to try to make sense of it in the context of the Caribbean, and actually to be inspired by it to write into poetry Caribbean rhythms that hadn't been heard there before. Ironically, again, through the mediation of this high canonical English poet. So it's those kinds of cross-cultural, cross-national connections that I think we can witness in miniature in poetry, because poetry is, it seems to me, an extraordinarily compressed form of art in which you often, if you pick it apart and look at it closely, you can see ingredients coming from many different places. You look at the language alone, there are ingredients from English, Arabic, Persian, French, German, all the rest, let alone the literary forms and traditions, haiku, pantoum, ghazal, sonnet, and so forth. All of these things that come circulate across national borders with increasing speed as the planet has become ever more globalized. So I wanted to draw ever more attention to that. Maybe particularly it seems important to do that when you live and work in the world's most powerful nation, which is often perhaps prone, sometimes for good reason, sometimes maybe not so, to a kind of exceptionalist thinking about itself. And so it seemed to me important for us to think about the ways in which even our anthems or the rhythms of our hymns or what have you, how these all come often through a kind of process of hybridization with other cultures, and thereby to undo notions of ever a kind of pure culture or an isolated nation.
Do you think this resurgence in xenophobic nationalism has affected what your choices might be for, like, an anthology or, future projects for you?
Yeah, I think it does. Sometimes you're not even aware of it at the time. But, for example, when I was anthologizing this last time, working on the 20th century part of the Norton Anthology of English Literature, I found myself drawing in, for example, some First World War poets who were, even at this time of extraordinary violence and unprecedented global scale, were trying to imagine their way into the shoes of the enemies on the other side. So it seemed to me that poetry can often be a really powerful way of getting outside of of precisely a kind of very narrowly defined and delimited experience, and experience the world as it is seen and felt and heard for different peoples of different cultures. I guess also, you know, it was very important for me as I've been working on these anthologies to draw in, for example, in working, you know, we often think of the English literary canon as this exclusively white, predominantly male canon. And yet, it seems to me some of the most exciting voices in terms of literature and English, even outside of America, are those voices that have emerged from the formerly colonized parts of the planet. Again, Africa, India, Caribbean, the Pacific Islands, and writers of color also who've arrived in Britain, what one poet calls a kind of colonization in reverse, from places like Jamaica and India, have taken the English language, made it their own, done exciting, powerful new things with that language, fertilizing it with metaphors from their indigenous traditions, pushing it in new and inventive directions. So yeah, I think you know, certainly the atmosphere informs my scholarship, and it's partly also by way of being responsive to, you know, students and what students are interested in nowadays, and that seems really important too. And I think our best students are really grappling with these issues now, and I think poetry in particular, but literature more generally, is a powerful space in which to think through these issues of ethnicity, race, nation, gender, that we sometimes think about in somewhat calcified, you know, predictable ways. Literature has a way of breaking open and, you know, our habitual ways of thinking, surprising us with new ways of thinking about those really important aspects of our shared experience.
So speaking of transnational, I know your family is of Persian descent. How did your family and upbringing influence your career?
So, you know, I it's interesting. I guess the most obvious, one of the most obvious elements is that in Persian culture, poetry has always been, you know, very powerful and very, very much prevalent. Even some of my relatives who were relatively illiterate can quote 13th century, 14th century poems at great length. In Persian culture, there's a game in which you have to cite a poem, and then depending on the sound or the letter that last poem ended with, then you're supposed to come up with a poem that starts with that same sound. And people can do this with extraordinary versatility in Persian culture. So I think it was probably there was an element of that. Probably there was an element also of growing up here in Charlottesville, Virginia, in Albemarle County, and being of Iranian and partly also of English descent, and feeling like a little bit of an outsider, and I think, you know, open to, yet someone who was very curious about and open to different kinds of experience. And I think literature often can be a way of a place in which to explore those kinds of complexities of being an insider and an outsider, exploring those spaces in between cultures. So probably that probably had an impact as well. You know, I haven't worked that much on Persian literature, but it's only more recently that I've actually started writing about it. Maybe in part because, again, 79 to 89% of Americans say they have a very negative view of Iran and of Persian culture. And I think it in part comes obviously out of the hostage crisis and the kind of national sentiment that's been whipped up in the face of that, and unfortunate leadership both in Iran and more recently, particularly in this country. But it seems to me that, again, literature can be an important way, if we think about a poet like Rumi, who's actually one of the most popular poets in America, mm-hmm. coming out of the Muslim experience and coming out of Persian culture to learn about this other culture.
Professor.
Yes.
May I put you on the spot? Who are some of these noteworthy poets that you are discovering that are not the classics. I know the classics are probably favorites of yours as well.
But. Yes. Yeah, so it's really always been important for me to both teach some of the great modern writers, people like Yeats and Pound and Eliot and Wolfe and Joyce and all the rest. But I have also really been interested as well in more contemporary writing, and it seems to me that there are a lot of we sometimes can be a little bit insular. In the U.S. in terms of focusing only on more kind of American writers, not always, but somewhat. And so I've been trying to expose my students and other readers to poetry from other parts of the world. There's, for example, the Jamaican poet laureate right now is a poet named Lorna Goodison. We actually brought her here to UVA just a couple of months ago, and she gave a marvelous reading. I think at the end of it, there wasn't a single person in the crowd who had completely dry eyes. And she explores, in just such resonant musical English, for example, aspects of the Jamaican experience, including enslavement and the complexities of it. I'm thinking, for example, of a poem in which she exhibits kind of sympathy both for an enslaved girl who's made to lie on her slave mistress's legs to keep them warm in the winter, and for the slave mistress, who is herself, by virtue of gender, subjugated under her husband's power as they live in Jamaica in these slave plantation times, conveying that kind of experience with nuance, subtlety, and imaginative power, I think is the work that someone like Lorna Goodison, A.K. Ramanujan in India, Okot Pabitek, a great Acholi poet from Uganda, whom I admire greatly, many others that I could rattle off. Anyway, those are just a few.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on trying to figure out further the relationship between poetry and the global. I just finished recently writing a piece about the great American poet Wallace Stevens and his work, trying to think about the way in which the human and the ecological are deeply interconnected, and trying to represent that in the interconnections of the English language, trying to imagine our place on the planet and on the globe. That's just one of many examples. I've worked recently on poetry in relation to tourism, poetry in relation to global warfare, trying to think about the poetry that is code-switching between different languages like Hmong and English, or Spanish and English, or French and English. These various ways in which poetry can help us to understand our global moment and our long global history, which goes, of course, all the way back to the Persian Empire, the Silk Road, and many other earlier moments, but has become ever more intense under modernity.
Okay, this is totally why, first of all, we don't need a palate cleanser, because no. I have to confess now I just want to take a poetry class.
Yes.
I thought I'd say that.
So,
and I know we're out.
Yeah, unfortunately we're running out of time, but thank you so much. It was very enlightening, Jahan Ramazani. And I think
totally.
As one of the founding editors of the Norton Anthology said to the New York Times when he was asked about, why is literature, what is literature, why is it so important? His answer was, and I think you might agree with, why live? So with that, everyone, go get your Nortons, get some poetry, and thank you so much once again for being here. Our music is by Springtide. Thanks, Nance. Thank you so much for being here with us.
Yeah.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Apropos of Something this morning on 94.7 WPBC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Show and hosts Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence each Saturday at 10 for Apropos of Something. Brought to you by the Beckham team at Keller Williams. Show archive can be found at SeavillePodcast.com.